Thanks so much. Glad to be here. Thanks to Rachel and Eileen for helping set up the program today. I am glad to be back in Sitka, which I visited many times in my previous careers working for Governors Cooper and Knowles. And the historic capital of Russian America is definitely the place to be this year as we celebrate the sesquicentennial anniversary of the U.S. purchase, as you all know. So thanks much for the opportunity. Today I wanted to talk about a groundbreaking time in Alaska's history, the melting of the Alaska-Russia ice curtain. For 40 years, this Cold War relic divided our countries and its citizens across the 55-mile Bering Strait. This era helped end the perilous Cold War and launched three decades of often chaotic but productive commercial, educational, scientific, and cultural ties across the international dateline. And I was honored to be a participant in the Ice Curtain era. Here, Governor Cooper and I stepped foot on Soviet soil for only the second time in our lives. And this was in a little tiny Soviet village called Uelin, which is the Soviet Union's northeasternmost village at the very tip of the Asian continent. And from a high point of land close to this spot, you actually can see mainland Alaska across the strait at the village of Wales. And I often look at this picture and think how lucky we were to have survived this adventure. I can still see the black smoke and oil spewing out of this Aeroflot helicopter as we crisscrossed the Bering Strait in 1989.
What's it say on there, David?
It says, rank occasionally has its privileges, oh. Huh? Which I think was a little tongue-in-cheek. So, what do I need to do to advance? Oh, okay, there. But let's begin this adventure a little bit earlier than 1980 in the 1980s. In fact, a century and a half earlier. Now, many Alaskans this year are marking the sesquicentennial anniversary, as I mentioned. And President Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward, who's sitting here to the left of the globe, negotiated what we now consider a great deal, $7.2 million, or 2 cents an acre. Today, Alaska generates that much in a couple of hours of oil production. And despite national derision at the time, Seward was enormously proud of this achievement. So proud that 3 years later, he traveled all the way here to Sitka, the capital of the new American possession. And here, he articulated his vision for the important role Alaska played in advancing America's international interests. He believed Alaska could help a U.S.-Russia relationship and strengthen America's role in the world. Now today, given current events, the jury may still be out on that. If nothing else, last year's election and the Trump-Putin relationship, whatever it may be, is keeping Russia in the news like never before. But let's return to that in a few minutes. And before anybody takes any offense at this photo, let me note that this picture is official fake news. So much changed with America's acquisition of Alaska 150 years ago, but one thing that remained constant was interaction between the indigenous peoples of the region. Since the time of the Bering Land Bridge 30,000 years ago, northern people crossed the icy waters between mainland Alaska and Russia for subsistence hunting and fishing and to share a similar culture. And here you can see the area we're talking about. The little square at the international dateline are the two Diomede Islands, 2.5 miles apart, and the mainlands are about 55 miles apart. In 1938, the U.S. and Soviet governments recognized the historic visitation between their native people and established a formal process for interactions among them. It allowed for visa-free visits and actually worked pretty well for about 10 years. And a productive U.S.-Soviet relationship continued during World War II as well. Nearly 8,000 American warplanes were delivered across the Bering Strait during Lend-Lease to help the Soviets fight the Nazis. But after all the goodwill generated during the war, Cold War suspicions froze decades of largely productive U.S.-Soviet relations. The Soviets banished natives from villages who lived on Little Diomede back to the mainland, and they established a border guard surveillance post aimed at Alaska. So FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover deemed that U.S. national security interests outweighed those of Alaska natives, and Joseph Stalin concurred. So just 10 years after the two countries set up a system that eased travel between Alaska and Russian natives, the two countries imposed an ice curtain. They sealed the border and banned all contact. This was imposed in May of 1948, and it lasted for 40 years. Now let's fast forward through the Cold War to the mid-1980s, when a drumbeat for change began in the isolated Bering Strait. And it was the result, I think, of three main factors. First, the memories of long separated native peoples were starting to fade, and they wanted one last opportunity for reunification before passing from the scene. As part of my book research, I interviewed some of these Alaska natives who live on St. Lawrence Island, and they were in their 80s and 90s just in the last couple of years. And they remember the last visits to relatives in the Soviet Union were in the 20s and 30s. And it was pretty amazing talking to these guys. The second factor was a new progressive Soviet leader came to power. Mikhail Gorbachev, who was head of Russia in the 80s, encouraged interaction with the West, which portrayed him to the world as a new type of reformist Soviet leader. And third, Alaska business and civic leaders started detecting an opening for interaction across the Bering Strait after 40 years. And what followed were a series of headline-grabbing initiatives by Alaskan and Russian citizen diplomats to pressure their national governments to open the strait. One was by a quirky realtor from Nome, a guy named Jim Stemfel. Stemfel was married to a native woman, and he had heard from her wife's family of visits with Russian natives decades ago, and he decided to do something to help reunite them. So one day he was at the Nome dump, and he noticed a stiff wind blowing west across the Bering Strait. So he had an idea. Instead of using a message in a bottle to send to Russia, how about some weather balloons? So he went to the National Weather Service and got these big balloons, blew them up with his car exhaust, hooked a little gift basket of goodies like sewing needles and chewing tobacco and tea, and a couple notes of friendship in Russian, and launched the balloon towards Russia. And he looked in the binoculars as it went off. Unfortunately, the two balloons that he launched never made it. But Stemfel was nothing if not persistent, and so a lot of his efforts did chip away at the ice curtain over the years. Another Alaskan was Dixie Belcher, who was a Juneau musician and peace advocate who was inspired to ease Cold War tensions. In 1986, Dixie secured permission for 67 Alaska natives and other performers to sing and dance their way across the USSR to promote peace. Governor Hammond, who's pictured here, and his wife Bella joined Dixie's trip, and their performances received international media attention. But I think the most important result of Dixie's initiatives was befriending a Soviet official who was well-connected inside the Kremlin and I think did more than anybody to open this era. And that's this guy in the middle here named Gennady Gerasimov. This is Dixie and Gerasimov in the center. He was a Gorbachev spokesman, spoke better English than all we did, knew American slang. He was on national and international television all the time. And Dixie brought him to Alaska several times, and he was really inspired seeing his country from Little Diomede. So he really worked inside the Kremlin to try to open the era. And so I think Dixie is owed a lot of credit for her efforts here. Another persistent Alaskan was Dr. Ted Mala. He was the son of a dashing Hollywood playboy, the Alaska native actor named Ray Mala. And his mother was a Russian princess and distant relative of Russia's last czar. And so Ted, after his parents died at a young age, grew up in the Hollywood area and wanted to come back to Alaska and get back in touch with his native roots. And at a conference that a couple of Russians attended, they discovered his ties to the Russian Tsar and said, you've got to come to Russia. And so that really started his career of pioneering efforts to try to open the Bering Strait to interaction between Alaskans and Russians. Another person who's inspired to bridge the Bering Strait was a California endurance swimmer named Lynn Cox. And she became the first person to swim between the Diomede Islands in 1987 in nothing but a Speedo, goggles, and swim cap. And here she is about to land on the Big Diomede. Keep in mind the water's 38 degrees, and there's sort of a funny story. She gets in the water at Little Diomede. She's about 2 hours into her swim, finally gets within sight of Big Diomede, and gets ready to land on the beach. And the Soviets had made a big deal out of this. They had a waiter in a white outfit serving tea out of samovars and little picnic tables. And she was getting ready to crash on this beach, and they said, "Don't land here, swim down to us down here." So she finally got herself down to the beach, and you can see it's snow covered. And when I talked to her, she said the thing that she remembers most distinctly, she couldn't get herself out of the water. She was so cold. And so these Soviet soldiers reached down, grabbed her by the wrists, and picked her up and set her on the beach. And she can still remember the warmth of their hands on her wrists when they pulled her out of the water. But Cox's feat drew attention to Cold War tensions internationally, won her audiences with the Pope, with President Reagan, and a state dinner salute from Gorbachev himself. Now, all these efforts and more to chip away at the ice curtain culminated in 1988 with the first initiative with serious business and political support, which is Alaska Airlines Friendship Flight. On June 13, 1988, the first ever U.S. jet departed Nome and sat down in Providenia on the gravel runway there, about 45 minutes away, carrying 82 passengers. There were business and political leaders, reporters and other hangers-on, but mostly there were Native elders who were on the flight to reunite with relatives on the other side. And one of the Natives on this flight was this young Siberian Yupik woman here, whose name is Darlene Pungawi Orr. And Darlene grew up on St. Lawrence Island on a now abandoned village within sight of the Soviet Union. And she grew up sort of spooked by the Soviet Union. She dreamed as a child of Soviet frogmen swimming up on the beach, and they found old military debris on the beach. And so she was really affected by her proximity to the Soviet Union. And she was sort of inspired to learn Russian. And so she was the only person on the flight who could speak Siberian Yupik, Russian, and English. And when she landed in Providenia and walked into the airport terminal, she immediately met a guy who was of the same native clan that she was from as well. Darlene now lives in Sitka. I'm going to see her this afternoon. And then this is a National Geographic photo of the reunification on the gravel runway in Providenia with the Alaska flight. You know Darlene? Yeah. Yeah. So she was very helpful to me in this project. So I got a choice seat on the Friendship Flight as Governor Cooper's press secretary. And like many Americans of this generation, I practice hiding from Soviet A-bombs under my elementary school desk at these raids that some of you may all have experienced. I discovered as I was researching this book that one of my dad's jobs as a Marine was arming missiles with nuclear warheads for use against the Soviet Union. So I was quite affected by the Soviet Union growing up as a kid, and I was pretty nervous about landing in Providenia for the first time. This picture was taken in the town square in Providenia, and you may know of, in Anchorage, there's a sort of comedian, Dr. White Keys, and so he encourages people to get pictures with spam in crazy places. And so this Rasputin-looking guy in the shades is a reporter, UPI reporter, Jeff Berliner, and he brought the spam. And I look at this picture and notice that there's only two people smiling in it, me and Vladimir Lenin on the side of the building there on the poster. So the Friendship Flight and the many initiatives which preceded it launched a nearly 30-year era of frenzied, emotional, and often successful interactions in business, culture, science, and education. After the flight, Alaskans and Soviets simply couldn't get enough of each other. Quick explanation of these photos. The top, you see a youthful Senator Murkowski and Governor Cooper. The guy in the middle is the mayor of Providenia, who worked with the realtor from Nome, Stemfel, quite a bit to open up relations. He was a real booster for his community, and some years later was shot gangland style, as happened to a lot of these Soviet leaders of the era. This woman down low is Jenna Brelsford. She was Cooper's trade assistant, and was so inspired by interactions with the Soviet Union that she joined an Alaska-Soviet ski and dog sled expedition in 1989 that went from Russia across the Bering Strait to Kotzebue. She's sitting on a Russian limousine. This is called a chaika, and you can chaika means seagull in Russian, and so you can sort of see the seagull emblem on the grill there. And then the guy on the other side is Dave Heatwald, who was a ARCO executive with the oil company in Anchorage, and he's one of the few Alaskans who actually was successful in making money in Russia during this era. Now, I love this cartoon. This is from Peter Dunlap's show with Anchorage Daily News. This Russian lady had just visited Anchorage, or Alaska, and she says, "The prosperity of the West is a sham, Boris. There's a facade of wealth, but as you can see, this jewelry I bought is made of moose nuggets." To me, this sort of exemplifies the era. So one of the most lasting legacies of this whole 30-year period was creation of the American-Russian Center at UAA, which started in 1993. And it was funded with about $26 million in federal money, mostly earmarks from Senator Stevens. And the Business Center did two things. They ran a business training to try to teach Russian entrepreneurs Western business practices. So they set up centers in seven of the major Far East cities and taught classes to Russians on how to be business people. And then we ran a cultural and educational program. And I worked there for a couple of years and managed the first Stevens $2 million grant for cultural and educational experiences. One of my memories of the era is there was no banking or credit system in Russia. You can see the fistful of rubles that this Tiffany, this woman, has here. So whenever we'd go over, we'd have to get like $10,000 in cash and strap it to our bodies to go over to Russia. It drove our university accountants crazy because they insisted on receipts for all that stuff. But over 15 years of operations, nearly 60,000 Russians were touched by UAA's business development and educational programs. And one of the Southeast American-Russian Center grant recipients is a woman named Joanne Grady of Juneau, who did groundbreaking work setting up women's centers in the Soviet Union when that was a foreign concept. And so she successfully set up centers in Magadan and in Petropavlovsk on the Kamchatka Peninsula, and this is a conference that she put together. So during the heyday of Alaska-Russian interaction, there was a flurry of activity across the strait. Alaska Airlines and other carriers such as Bering Air and Revolution and even Russian carriers established regular air links. Alaska Airlines operated for like 5 years from Anchorage to most of the Far East. Businesses explored joint ventures from beer breweries to oil refineries. More than a dozen sister city relationships were established in Juneau and Vladivostok, Anchorage, and Magadan. And I remember going on one of the Juneau sister city trips to Vladivostok, and a couple days before we left, there was a little bear who had been orphaned. And so somebody had the wise idea to take this bear and present it to the Russians as a gift of friendship. So we took it over in a dog kennel, and a fish and game guy with leather gloves took the bear out of the kennel to present it to the Russian official, and this feisty little bear almost bit the thumb off the Russian guy. And it didn't create too much of an international incident, but just yet one more crazy story from the era. And about three dozen Rotary clubs were set up by Alaskans in the Russian Far East and introduced this foreign concept of community service to the Russians. And the clubs actually did good work taking care of senior citizens and doing kids programs in the Russian Far East. And scores of Russians and Alaskans also got married during this period, and many of the marriages continue today.
Did the Rotary clubs continue?
Most of them are pretty dormant. A few of them are still in operation, but there's not much Alaska involvement. So quick rundown on these photos. This is the second Alaska Airlines flight to land in Russia. This is in Anadyr, the capital of Chukotka. It's about 10 below with about a 40 knot wind, and this is dropping off the ski expedition that I talked about it from 89. Governor Knowles and his counterpart from Sakhalin Island, Governor Farkudinov, and Sakhalin was the site of a big oil and gas development. A lot of Alaskans worked over there. And these guys became pretty good buddies Farkey, as we called him, came to Alaska many times. He was actually killed in a plane crash under mysterious circumstances, surveying oil and gas in his area. And then this guy in the lower corner is Doug Drum, who runs Indian Valley Meats in Anchorage. And he's sort of the quintessential example of an Alaskan who went to Russia for all the right reasons. He wanted to help reduce the waste in the reindeer processing operation in the Russian Far East. And he was taken to the cleaners by the Russians and lost a couple million dollars in the process. So by the late 1990s, relations across the strait began to cool for five key reasons. First, the Russian economy was just simply too chaotic for Alaskans and other Westerners. There was a overnight devaluation of the ruble in August of 1998. Dave Heatwald, the guy from ARCO that I had a picture of earlier, represented Carr Gottstein. And they had a warehouse in Magadan full of about $2 million worth of food, like hot dogs and frozen strawberries and ice cream, that the Russians really loved. But basically, overnight, the value of this, all these products was worth half. And so Carr Gottstein, like a lot of Western companies, just threw up their hands and said, we're out of here. We're not going to put up with this anymore. Alaska Airlines ended service in October of 1998. And one of the reasons was they had a plane taking off from the Sakhalin Airport, and the runway was built out of concrete blocks. And to seal the cracks in the blocks, the Russians would put hot tar and sort of melt the tar into the cracks. So this plane takes off, sucks all this hot tar into the engine exploded, the plane got down on the ground, nobody was hurt. But it created a huge international incident. Alaska had to fly in a new engine at great expense. And a couple weeks later, they pulled the plug on their service and walked away. The earmarks that Senator Stevens was sending to the American-Russian Center at the university started drying up. Russia was no longer sexy. A lot of federal money was going to Afghanistan. And I think the thrill started to dissipate for Alaskans who were hosting Russians. I don't know, did anybody in this room ever host any Russians during this period? Up in Anchorage, we would show up at the airport in the dead of night, and you'd put up two or three people. They wouldn't have any money. You'd house them for a couple of weeks, feed them, show them around. And this happened time after time. And people just got sort of tired of this after a number of years. And then the fifth and final reason is Putin came to power in 2000. And initially, he stabilized the chaotic Russian economy under Yeltsin. But one thing he did do was re-centralize authority. Under Yeltsin and Gorbachev, they extended authority to the regions to negotiate business deals and cultural relationships with Alaska. But Putin pulled all that back to Moscow, re-centralized everything, and cracked down on Westerners. I was in the Russian Far East last summer with nine other Alaskans visiting communities along the Bering Sea coast. And for a minor paperwork violation, we were arrested by the border guards, held for 16 hours, paraded in front of a federal judge, and had to plead guilty to this minor violation and fine 500 rubles each, which was $8 for our time. But there's a lot of this sort of petty harassment that goes on these days, which makes it very difficult to deal with Russia. So despite these setbacks, I do believe Alaska's model of citizen diplomacy does offer a lesson for overall U.S.-Russian relations. And I've gleaned what I think are five lessons from the Ice Curtain era, which I think are instructive for today. First, we can help explain perplexing Russian behavior to other Americans, because I think we know Russians better than other folks. You know, we all snicker at these photos of Putin as an aircraft pilot or shirtless on a horseback, but these characterizations of him as an exciting, strong leader play very well in Russia. He's got like an 80% job approval rating over there. I mean, it helps that he controls all the media and all the elections process, so nobody can run against him or really resist. But keep in mind, you know, as the daily headlines that we all see, that Putin really has two goals in life: to keep himself in office and to make Russia great again. He's been quoted as saying the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And so I think that a lot of that explains his behavior in the Ukraine and Georgia and places like that as he tries to bring these satellites back into Russia. The second lesson is both sides are well advised to avoid diplomatic slights, which set back relationships. Obama, when he came into office, actually had a pretty good relationship with Putin. They produced a lot of progress, but things quickly went south when Obama dismissed Russia as a regional power, which offended Putin. So we've got to avoid that kind of stuff. Third, we have seen that science can help overcome politics. During the Cold War, and even now, joint scientific research between Alaska and Russia continues, leading to promising areas of cooperation. For example, UAF has a walrus monitoring study going on with Russia right now, which is productive to the native people of the region. And I think the Arctic is the greatest area of potential cooperation between us. Nearly half of the world's Arctic falls within Russia, and we all know that the U.S. is an Arctic nation only because of Alaska, so I think that we can play a key role here. Fourth, native links can build bridges between people, and today we certainly need stronger bonds in this area. One of the great achievements from the Ice Curtain era was the approval of visa-free travel for natives of the region, and that continues today, although it does struggle from bureaucratic challenges and a lack of funding. And fifth and finally, I believe there's a lot of merit in the personal relationships between Alaskans and Russians that are established across the strait. We're both northern people, distant from our national capitals. We face similar problems to which similar solutions can work. And organizations like the Northern Forum and the Institute of the North have demonstrated that we can solve common problems across international borders. And I give kudos to Governor Walker. His two predecessors pulled Alaska out of the Northern Forum, which is a regional government institution, and he put Alaska back in, which, you know, starts the conversation again with Russia. And people like Juno's Jana Lelchuk here, the woman in the center, she's the Russian teacher in Juno High Schools, and she has done a lot for the last 25 years to help promote Russian language and culture and keep relations across the strait alive. So last summer I mentioned I was in the Russian Far East, and this picture is the northeasternmost point, the closest point to Alaska. The landmass you can see on the horizon is Big Diomede Island looking towards Alaska. And then the little island, or the mainland of Wales, there's a little mountain in Wales, not far from Nome. You can't really see it, but you can by the naked eye from there. So I was wandering the streets of Providenia waiting for our trip back home and feeling a little glum over the passing of an era of such high expectations between Alaska and the Russian Far East. And suddenly this Russian, local Russian guy rushed up to me, recognized me as a foreigner and asked where I was from. And when I explained in my rusty Russian that I was from Alaska, he pointed at the eastern horizon and gave me a wide grin and a hearty thumbs up. And to me, that underscores the importance of continued interaction between Alaska and the Russian Far East. So there's a lot more detail and a lot more of the crazy stories of this era in my book, Melting the Ice Curtain. It's published by the University of Alaska Press with a little bit of assistance from the Rasmussen Foundation. I have copies over here for sale if anybody's interested. They should be available at local bookstores as well. And I left cards on the table with links to my personal website about my schedule for book travel, and also how to get a hold of the publisher. So, spasibo bolshoi. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions if you guys, is there time for questions? I think there are, you know, some of the hardline communists in Russia continue to believe that. Putin was asked about it at one of his public town halls a couple years ago. Does he want Russia, Alaska back? And he sort of laughed and dismissed it and said, nah, why do we want Alaska? It's too cold there. So, you know, there's conspiracy theories that the check was never canceled. And so I think most serious people pretty much dismiss it. Others?
Well, I mean, the message you're, I think the message you're bringing is great. How are we, how's that going to happen? Are the legislative people working on this, or what the book's about? Or?
Well, no, I think the point is it's really citizens who can make these connections. We did a breakthrough during the height of the Cold War in the mid-1980s. And given, I mean, granted, things have changed dramatically now. We don't have Gorbachev there encouraging interaction with the West. We have Putin resisting interaction with the West. So there are some formidable challenges. I think the native exchanges is a good thing. There's a woman in Anchorage named Tandy Wallach with Circumpolar Expeditions. She does sort of adventure travel. And she's putting together a little Diomede family reunion next month. And so she's bringing a bunch of Russian natives over from the Russian mainland, who used to live on Big Diomede, but were banished to the mainland, for a reunion with Alaska natives. And you know, it's a small step, but it just keeps people talking. It's very difficult to get to Russia these days. If you want to travel to the Far East, you pretty much go to Nome and then take Bering Air. You charter Bering Air from Nome to Providenia or Chukotka. But if you want to go to the bigger cities, you got to fly to Seattle and then to Seoul, Korea, and then up the coast, or go all the way around the world through Moscow. So it's enormously much more challenging than it used to be. There is a Russian carrier that operates, I think, 6 weeks of charter service in the summer, connecting the Kamchatka Peninsula and Anchorage. And a lot of sports people, hunters and fishermen, go to Kamchatka Peninsula. So that's the traffic for that. But, okay.
I can give you kind of an update. When I was in Ketchikan, I was along the Rotary, and we went to Magadan. Mm-hmm. And it was all the Russian, all Alaska, and also the Yukon. And we flew to Anchorage, but then we took Aeroflot to Magadan.
Right.
And then coming back on Aeroflot, they didn't know how to get back to Anchorage. It was kind of exciting. But it turned out that the people that were the communists, after the collapse, they came and visited. The same people we met that were the communist people were now Rotarians.
Right.
And it was part of the Alaska region, and then whatever the big shot said, we're not going to do it anymore.
I think that,
a good shot.
Yeah, there's a lot of lasting benefit. There are a lot of warm feelings on the Russian side when we were over there last summer. I mean, people are just passionate about coming back to Alaska, but it's pretty expensive for them.
Our superintendent at the time, John Holst, we hosted a couple of Russian kids. Mm-hmm. That they brought over. They had $1,500 in their pocket.
Wow.
I know I bought her a pair of shoes before I found that out.
Yeah.
Is it not sneakers?
Anything else?
Great. Well,
okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.